The Criminal Justice Subcommittee will come to order. Lindsay, please call the roll.
Chair Trunau?
Here.
Vice Chair Barnaby?
Here.
Ranking Member Rayner Gillsby?
Here.
Representatives Abbott?
Here.
Baker?
Here.
Brackett?
Here.
Bracy Davis?
Here.
Brannan?
Here.
Casello?
Here.
Garcia?
Here.
Gottlieb?
Here.
Jock?
Here.
Michael? Michael? Plakin?
Here.
Silvers has been excused. Stark?
Here.
Tuck?
Here.
Yurkowski?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lindsay. Before we begin, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. I also request that you please fill out a public appearance card if you intend to speak before the committee. Members, building off the presentations we heard last week from agencies under our jurisdiction, today we are going to hear from or take a different look at criminal justice system by hearing from the professionals that work inside our courtrooms every day. Today, we will hear from the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association, the Florida Public Defenders Association, and the Office of Criminal Conflict and Civil Regional Counsel. Our presenters will tell us about their respective roles within criminal justice system and also tell us a little bit about their responsibilities on a daily basis. First, we are joined by Bill Gladstone, State Attorney for the 5th Judicial Circuit, who is representing the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association. Mr. Gladstone was elected State Attorney for the 5th Judicial Circuit in November of 2020. As a State Attorney, he serves the citizens of Citrus, Hernando, Lake, Marion, and Sumter counties. Mr. Gladstone is a former law enforcement officer and a career prosecutor with over 20 years of trial experience. Mr. Gladstone graduated from the University of Florida in 1994 with a bachelor's degree in criminology and received his Juris Doctor from St. Thomas University School of Law in Miami in 1997. During his career as state attorney's office, Mr. Gladstone has prosecuted all types of crimes from misdemeanors to capital murder cases. He is the former president of the Florida Criminal Justice Executive Institute Association and served two terms on the Florida Bar's Fifth Circuit Grievance Committee. Mr. Gladstone, thank you for being with us today. You are recognized.
Thank you, committee members. It is an honor to be before you here today on behalf of the Florida Prosecuting Attorneys Association. It really is a great opportunity to engage with everybody here to give an overview of what the role of the state attorneys are in the state of Florida. And to start with, I'll say our overriding mission is to seek justice on behalf of all the people of the state of Florida. And to do that, there are 20 elected state attorneys throughout the state. There are around 1,700 current assistant state attorneys in the state of Florida. And keep in mind, there's over 22 million people in the state of Florida now. Our authority comes from Article 5 of the Constitution. We are the chief prosecuting authority in each circuit. Chapter 27 of the Florida statute says, the state attorney shall prosecute or defend on behalf of the state all suits, applications, or motions, civil or criminal, in which the state is a party. Some of our statutory obligations, some of our duties, I'm going to go through now, but you have to understand, we prosecute all criminal cases that come to through the state court system. And those 1,750 prosecutors right now are prosecuting those cases. Now, not every case gets prosecuted, and I'll go through some of those topics as we move on. But in addition to prosecuting cases, we manage and run pretrial intervention programs, ways of diverting somebody out of the system that we've identified that should be eligible for a diversion program, and I'll cover that a little bit as well. But we also assist victims with domestic violence injunctions. We have responsibilities when it comes to sexual predators and civil commitments to make sure that if someone is a sexual offender or a sexual predator and they've been to prison, that they're properly screened, and if necessary, seek their commitment at the end of their prison term to make sure that they remain, they're not a threat to society. And we have public record obligations as a state agency, which we deal with on a day-to-day basis. All the prosecutors have to deal with that. We also have data collection and transparency responsibilities to make sure that our data is available either through public record or through requests so people can analyze what it is that we do. We are the legal advisor to the grand juries, and in Florida, the grand jury is required for any indictment on a capital murder case. We also assist in many circuits, assist law enforcement officers with risk protection orders, which are orders when a person is determined to be potentially violent or has firearms and has either pending charges or has created an imminent threat. We can assist with law enforcement in filing those applications or file them ourselves to make sure that the public stays safe. We have statutory obligations to review Sunshine Law complaints and violations that deal with local government and counties and municipalities. And each state attorney has a staff that consists of, in addition to IT and support staff that keep the offices running every day, assistant state attorneys that specialize in different types of units. So for example, there are prosecutors that handle capital cases, and many offices are going to have capital case units. Violent crimes and career criminals, the statutes require us to identify career criminals and give extra effort, make an extra concerted effort to make sure that we identify those career criminals and prosecute them. We have units that prosecute just sex cases, whether it's adult sex cases or sex cases that involve children. We have juvenile division, which handles juvenile prosecutions. Organized white-collar crime, we have prosecutors that specialize in wiretap investigations, interceptions. We have elderly exploitation. Some offices are going to have specialized prosecutions dealing with that. You know, our elderly population and our children are the most vulnerable at times, and they need to have those special attention. Many of the prosecutors work on cold case squads with sheriff's offices and police departments throughout the state to make sure that those older cases get a chance to be looked at. Many prosecutors respond to traffic homicides and vehicular homicides and regular homicides, and they're on call sometimes 24 hours a day during their on-call week. Because law enforcement needs assistance at times, we are there for them. We appear in court 365 days a year. Of course, not everybody does, but there's first appearances on the weekends, every day of this year throughout the state. We are staffed with investigators. And investigators, their job is to make sure that the prosecutor can get the things that the prosecutor needs to make a case or to make a decision on a case. Perhaps they're not going to file. The investigator can also serve subpoenas, take statements, collect additional evidence, look at body cameras, whatever those things might be. Investigators help with those activities. We also have victim advocates who perform a vital function to make sure that victims of crime in the state of Florida are aware of their rights, make sure that victims know that they have certain rights to be present, to be heard, and have a voice in the criminal justice system. And our victim advocates will also make sure that if there's crimes compensation that's available, the victims know about it, and they'll know how to apply for it so they can be made whole if that's possible. Prosecutors do a lot of those things as well. And interface with the prosecutor's offices and the victims is crucial because victims need continuity. They need to know their prosecutor. They need to understand the system. Otherwise, it's just such a foreign system, if you think about it. If you're an innocent victim and you get put in a situation where now you're dealing with strangers and you're having to tell your story and you're having to explain what happened, that's a difficult thing to do. So having advocates and prosecutors that are empathetic and understanding really makes a difference for our citizens. When we get a case, it's usually by arrest. It's usually by an arrest over perhaps from law enforcement directly without our involvement. But there are times where we work with law enforcement before arrest, where they're making a case and where they're looking at investigating a particular issue. But we have to make a decision whether we're going to prosecute our criminal cases or drop them or divert them, typically within 21 days, which is a pretty quick turnaround. We can get some extensions, but generally speaking, we're making a filing decision within around 21 days. We have to believe that we have a good faith basis, that we can prove each element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a lot different than the probable cause standard that law enforcement works with. So we're looking at it from a different angle. Are we going to be able to prove this to a jury, each element beyond a reasonable doubt, with the evidence that we have that's admissible? Sometimes we make decisions to drop charges, and that doesn't necessarily mean it didn't happen. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it means that the evidence isn't there. The decision has to be reviewed by us, and we decide that it's not a case that we're going to go forward with. There might be issues with evidence. There might be issues with witnesses. We might not be able to prove a particular element of the case. So we have to make those decisions as well. And as I mentioned before, there's going to be times where we are going to divert cases out of the system. We might identify a first-time offender, a nonviolent offender, who's interested in getting help, or we recognize could benefit from a particular program. And many circuits have veterans court, mental health court, some have DUI courts. We have all types of ways, pretrial intervention, drug court, where we can divert someone from a traditional track to a place where they can have counselors and assistance for staffing and helping them get back on their feet, recognizing that not every person is unique, not every case is unique, and some situations lend themselves to a diversion. And those cases and those, when we make those decisions, there are times when you can really see how it's helpful, and it helps the person develop and get back on their feet without a criminal record, without something that necessarily holds them back. So all of those things are, we're typically doing those within 21, 30 days. And that's a lot to do, but we do that by intaking, trying to meet every single material witness in the case, or at least speaking with them on the phone. We're gathering evidence. We're having our investigators get those Ring doorbell cameras or those body cameras and look through those evidence issues and reading the reports to try to make our filing decision. Our prosecutors throughout the state work every single day with every single sheriff's office in the state. They work with every police department, the Florida Department of Corrections, the Inspector General, the Florida Highway Patrol, Fish and Wildlife, you know, Department of Corrections, FDLE, and FDLE's lab. I mean, they are interfacing every single day on the phone. They are working hard to make sure they gather all this evidence. And it doesn't stop. You know, every day you get a new, you start a new day and you've got another 15 cases that were added onto your docket. So that's an overview of what we do. We also work every single day with our counterparts at the Public Defender's Office and Regional Conflict Council and the private bar to make sure the entire system works efficiently. Because if we communicate with them and they communicate with us and we communicate with the judges, you know, it benefits the victims. That's the way I see it. You know, when the victims are when they receive the benefits of a case that's able to move quickly through the system or quicker because we communicate, that makes the whole system work better. So we do our best to do that throughout the state. So with that, I would ask if you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gladstone. Committee, we have any questions? Representative Yakarski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Bill, for coming and testifying. Good information. I have a question, kind of a general question. And thankfully, we live in the greatest state in the nation, and we have a great governor who supports law enforcement and law and order in a big way. But we've got a lot of bad actors in this world, and recruiting state attorneys, in my opinion, that take soft on crime and lenient approaches. I think if there's one thing we know about this country, one of the greatest things about this country is the law and order law enforcement system that we have, because without law and order, what do we really have? Especially, you know, families and businesses, et cetera. So my concern is, in the nation's watching what Florida is doing, everything we're doing now. And I want to know, what is the, as your association, I assume that all the state attorneys are members of that, I would hope. If not, I'd like to know why. But what is the standard operating procedure and the accountability and continuity that you guys hold each other to make sure that we're not, in certain areas, not prosecuting crimes, letting people out, not moving forward on things that, say, in your district, you would be prosecuting, just to make sure, again, that there's continuity, accountability, and I'm a man of redemption. I'm a man for grace and mercy all day long. I get that, too. But, you know, when we have explosive population growth, I believe that's going to be the biggest issue we're going to deal with in the years to come. And the last thing we want to do is let the devil in the details come in. We're starting to let people out. We're not prosecuting things. And next thing, we see what that's doing in other states, and it's not good at all. So I'd love for you to comment on that and sort of how you all hold each other accountable to a standard of what we're prosecuting and what we're not in this state. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman.
Recognized.
Yes, sir. There are 20 circuits in the state of Florida, and each circuit's represented by an elected prosecutor who answers to the people that elected him or her in office. Our organization has 19 members, and we meet several times a year as a board and as an organization to help provide training and education to all of our different prosecutors. We discuss topics, we discuss issues, we discuss legislation, and we discuss, you know, a whole myriad of things, but we all recognize that as independent constitutional officers, we answer to our people. We all recognize that we all take an oath, and the oath is serious, and it means something, because when you take an oath that you're going to follow the law, that's what the people expect you to do. As to your question, how we hold each other accountable, I think we do a good job of communicating with each other about all the myriad of topics that you're talking about. Everybody is, you know, it's everybody in our association, and every single prosecutor is working hard every single day to try to keep the people of the state of Florida safe. Some people might do that differently than others, and the way that a certain prosecutor or a prosecutor's office, and this is not just an elected, and individual prosecutors can look at certain facts and disagree. That's what lawyers do. There's going to have to be some discretion there between the electeds and also the individual prosecutors. And not everybody looks at something the same way. So I think that discretion needs to be there. I can only speak for myself. I make sure that the people that work in the Fifth Circuit understand what I believe to be our mission and have buy-in on that mission to make sure that, you know, for example, in my circuit, you know, I have a mission statement. The top thing is public safety. I mean, that's the very top thing, because we answer to the public. We want to keep them safe. So I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Chairman. Just a statement. I understand that about the elected positions, and I have deep respect for that. I just want to state, I've said this before, I believe that public safety is the most fundamental function of government. I commend you for what you do, and all of you for being here today. Thanks for your time.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Ranking Member Rayner Goolsbee.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much. I've practiced in your circuit as a defense attorney, and while I started my career as a public defender, I have great respect for the work that you do.
You
mentioned a word, discretion, and for those of us who aren't lawyers or aren't prosecutors, could you just define what discretion means, prosecutorial discretion, per the Florida Constitution, and the way that you view it? Thank you.
Yes.
You're recognized.
When I get assigned a case, and I've got a paper file, or actually now I've got a digital file right in front of me, and I'm looking at it. I'm looking at a police report from an arrest the night before, and I've got to decide, you know, how strong is this case? Are the elements there? Do I have the time to get additional evidence, maybe to put it together, or am I under the gun to have to make a decision right away? How strong is a particular witness's testimony? How strong is a particular piece of evidence? Is that evidence available? All of those things need to be evaluated on a pretty rapid, you know, kind of almost triage-type basis. So when I say discretion, I mean a prosecutor with 15 years might look at a particular set of facts one way, and a prosecutor who's 6 months out of law school might look at it a little bit differently. So we make sure that we have, you know, supervisors, or at least in my office, I speak for myself, we have people that can impart their experience and their wisdom when a new prosecutor is making the decision, so they can kind of look not just right immediately what's in front of them, but a little bit down the road to kind of see how it's going to play out. But that was my explanation of discretion. Yes.
Thank you for that. Anyone else? I got a question on diversion.
Yes, sir.
Can you give a specific event that's happened with diversion that maybe in the DJJ world that would explain how the system works a little bit?
I think if I could, I'll use Veterans Court as an example, if that's all right.
Okay.
To me, Veterans Court seems to be to work the best, at least in my circuit, and I'm speaking for the Fifth Circuit. Veterans Court is staffed with veterans, with mental health experts, with volunteers, with a judge that wants to make sure that the program works. And if we identify a veteran with a service-related disability or injury that's arrested for a particular charge that qualifies, and we decide that that veteran would be better served and the people would be better served by going into this program, they'll go to, if they get screened and approved and go into that program, literally an office full of people will be there to help that person from that journey, from day one, when they are getting explained that they've been arrested, but they're going to go into this program, to make sure they make every appointment, to make sure that they get a job, to make sure that they see their doctor, to make sure that they take their medication. And those programs, like in Veterans Court in particular, has a really high success rate because of the support. So that's how that works. There are programs for juveniles. There are programs, like I said, for drug court. They're not, in my circuit, I'll speak, they're not as staffed as well as Veterans Court, and there's a lot more people in them. So a common misunderstanding about diversion courts is that they take a burden off of the system for the prosecutors, and I won't speak for the public defenders, but when a person goes into a program, we still have to staff that. So we're still sending a prosecutor over to, and now it's not just one case, it might be five cases, but it might take all afternoon meeting with the doctors and meeting with all those people. So it actually ends up eating into a lot of time. The idea is good and the execution can be good and the results can be good, but it's not a time saver. And a lot of people think we'll have a diversion program because it's going to save time. It actually doesn't, in my opinion. But it's still helpful, if that answers your question.
Thank you for that. Anyone else? Representative, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, if you could answer for me, when you spoke about victim services, do you have sufficient, are we covered? Do we have sufficient victim services? Are they coordinators, or do we have them per the cases that you all are seeing that's available in this to make sure that our families and the victims of the families have the help that they need?
That's an excellent question, and I can only speak, I can't speak on behalf of all of the state attorney's offices. Of course, we're all staffed a little bit differently. We can always use more assistance with victim services. Our victim advocates are constantly setting appointments and setting intakes. And if we have a trial that lasts 2 or 3 weeks, there's an advocate that's with that family member or the survivors of a homicide with them the entire time, because it's, the one thing that typically stays constant throughout a criminal case is going to be the victim advocate. You might have a change in prosecutors. It might go to a different judge. There might be a different public defender or defense attorney. But we try to make sure that the advocate stays the same so that that victim is has a familiar face. We could always use more. I think right now, statewide, there's, of course, a workforce shortage and a shortage with prosecutors. And, we actually have more cases now than we did this time last year. Fewer prosecutors means things work less efficient sometimes, and it means we have to rely more and more on our victim advocates to develop that relationship. Prosecutors are going to want to meet their victims. They're going to want to meet those people that are going to testify. They're going to want to see and hear how they explain something themselves. But sometimes we have to rely on advocates to do those initial intakes.
Thank you for that. Representative Brackett.
Thank you, Chair. We know that throughout a number of industries, there's a shortage of employees. I've spoken quite in depth with Tom Backetall, who's the 19th Circuit Judicial State Attorney. And can you speak to recruitment of what you're doing? Because I know that he spoke to me about it a number of times, and he's struggling to find good help right now.
Yes. Tom and I have talked a lot about recruitment. So we used to, going back 5 years ago, and since I started in 98, people coming out of law school wanted to work at the public defender's office. They wanted to work at the state attorney's office. They wanted to get trial experience. And it seemed that there was a steady flow of resumes coming in regularly all the way up until COVID. Those resumes coming in sometimes would come in at such a volume that it was difficult to even kind of, you'd run in and you'd have five people in front of you, and you might have to tell them you've read the resume, but you're reading it while you're talking to them. So that shut off, and we have done We've outreach at every single law school in the state of Florida. You know, we are probably, most of us are probably advertising for assistant state attorneys. We're doing everything we can. The problem is it's difficult to be competitive with the private market right now. And you know, we've made some good inroads over the last couple of legislative sessions to help increase our base salary and increase the amount of funding for prosecutors. But I think it just needs to go more, because I think it's really hard to compete with people graduating law school that are making $80,000, $90,000 a year. And some of them are working from home. Some of them are promised that they don't have to go to court. And it just gets better and better and better. And what we do is we want to train people to be advocates, advocates for the state, advocates for their client, advocates for victims. And the only way to advocate is to be a lawyer who gets up and speaks to people. So if you want to work from home and for $80,000, and there's a lot of, you know, there are a bunch of shy lawyers out there, that works. But it's making it difficult for us to recruit. Some of us are hiring people back that over the last few years want to come back and work in state service. Any former prosecutor you talk to, most of them are going to say that was some of the best time practicing law that they ever had. So we have people coming back, but it's just difficult. And the more vacancies we have, the slower cases move through the system and the less victims that are served. And that's just the reality of it, because the people that are left working in, and I'll speak for my office, the ones that are still remaining in my office, and we're 15 positions down, 12 prosecutors, they're the ones who made it through the last 2 years. They're the ones who pushed through and worked through all that and gave it all and have made a difference. So they deserve more. So there you
go. All right. Well, thank you for being here today.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Any more questions?
Next, we will hear from Carlos Martinez, public defender of the 11th Judicial Circuit, on behalf of the Florida Public Defenders Association. Mr. Martinez is the public defender for the 11th Judicial Circuit in Miami-Dade County, Florida. He graduated from Florida International University with a bachelor's degree in political science in 1985 and received his JD from University of Miami in 1990. Before becoming public defender, Mr. Martinez was a top administrator in the public defender's office for 12 years and led litigation efforts, designed and implemented management and legal reforms, and drafted legislations and grant proposals. Mr. Martinez was elected public defender in 2008 and reelected in 2012, 2016, and 2020. He is currently serving a two-year term as the president of the Florida Public Defenders Association. Mr. Martinez, thank you for being here today. You are recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for inviting us to speak to you today. I want to mention there are a couple of other elected public defenders present, Stacy Scott from the 8th Circuit and Jessica Yeary from this circuit here in Tallahassee. And I'm glad they're here. So first off, if we could go to the next slide. I don't know how to, just do it here. There we go. I can do it myself.
The clicker's right on your.
Okay, you here's the controller. Perfect. So the first thing I want to say is thank you. What you all did, what the legislature did last year, was provide large increases for public defenders and prosecutors and regional counsel as well. What that did for most of us, it helped slow down the bleeding. Our system has been bleeding lawyers, prosecutors, and public defenders now for about 3 years. And it's gotten worse, but it got a little better. What you all did with that is actually signal the importance of maintaining and trying to get the system back to working before COVID. I'm going to get back to some issues, some of the contextual issues as to what's happening with the backlogs and what's happening with the attrition of lawyers and the fact that the prosecutor's office and our offices cannot be bringing people in. But first, let me give you an overview of what we do. Florida was the first state in the nation to create a public defender system back in 1963. And public defenders as state attorneys are in the state constitution as constitutional officers. Public defenders represent your constituents who are accused of offenses who cannot afford to hire an attorney, and also your constituents who may be having mental health issues, and they're charged through the Baker Act, and they may be a danger to themselves or to others. We represent those individuals in court. There are 20 elected public defenders, and there are about 1,300 assistant public defenders. We are appointed to juvenile cases, misdemeanor cases, felony cases, death penalty cases, and appeals as well. There are 5 out of the 20 offices that handle appeals, defense appeals. We are also appointed to certain civil cases as well, the Baker Act that I mentioned, medication hearings, and continued commitment hearings at state hospitals, as well as sexually violent predator cases, the Jimmy Rice cases. We represent on all of those cases. The public defenders perform core functions that are mandated by the Constitution and also by state statutes. So our authority flows from that. As Mr. Gladson mentioned, we are equal partners when it comes to the justice system, because all of us have to work together to make sure that there's justice happening in our courtrooms throughout the state of Florida. And the function of the public defender is crucial for public safety. You heard Mr. Gladson mention that when you have delays, when you don't have sufficient number of prosecutors, the cases languish, and sometimes the witnesses disappear. I know there are a lot of cases from 2020 when a lot of folks from Miami-Dade County moved out of town, that the cases were dismissed just because the witnesses were no longer showing up. They did not come to court. So it has a huge impact on the quality of justice and our safety in our communities when we do not have the appropriate number of prosecutors, of experienced prosecutors and experienced defenders working in our courthouses. So what do we do every day? We are in bond hearings every day. So when someone gets arrested, they appear in a bond hearing within 24 hours. We do that 365 days a year throughout the state of Florida. We have attorneys in criminal and juvenile courtrooms throughout the state in person every day. We staff the drug courts, the mental health courts, Baker Act hearings, and veterans courts. And the work that the attorneys do every day is that they interview incarcerated clients and clients who are out of custody. They talk to witnesses, review thousands of hours of body-worn camera video, and Mr. Gladson mentioned how time-consuming that is. So the lawyers and the staff do that. Lawyers also research the law to see, are there motions to be filed, file the motions, work with the courts, prosecution, and treatment providers to assist our clients with mental health and substance abuse issues. We also have hearings, we try cases, and we appeal cases. So, of course, that's where I should. I'm a little behind on my numbers here. So here are the facts as we have them. So statewide, new cases in the last fiscal year, we had 521,377 cases in all 20 circuits. And what that represents, it meant 431,519 individuals. That is just new cases. That's just the cases that we were appointed on during the year. But as you can imagine, at the beginning of the year, you start out with the cases that you have open. So right now in Miami-Dade County, I have almost 15,000 open cases. And this year, I will probably pick up about 50,000 new cases. The work that the prosecutors do and that we do is not the cases that are open and closed within a year, but it's actually the cases that are pending. Those are the cases that you're going to court on, that you're talking to victims, you're talking to witnesses, and you're preparing your cases. So that's a very important piece. One of the things that we have learned throughout the years is that you have individuals that one day are victims and the next day they're defendants. So our clients, a large number of our clients have been victimized previously. The big challenge that they have is once they become a defendant and they have a conviction, they are no longer eligible in the future for victim services. And that's a policy issue, and I'm sure we'll discuss it at another point, but I wanted to mention that because that's something that goes unstated a lot of times, and individuals need to get victim services, whether they were a defendant before or not. So 20 independent offices, 20 individual budgets. Our budget at the trial level was $287 million and $20 million for the appellate level. At 96% of our GR state budget is salary and benefits. We have about 3,000 FTEs statewide, but right now we have about 250 vacancies for our lawyers. So let me mention what is happening to our offices that is impacting justice in the courtroom and on the street. We've been hit by a double whammy that Mr. Gladson already mentioned, which is we have a hiring crisis. We are not attracting enough lawyers in Florida because of the low salaries, the high cost of living in every area of this state. It used to be that we would only say, oh, it's happening in Miami, it's happening in Orlando, it's happening in Tampa. Talking to my brethren public defenders, these issues are happening in small, large circuits, it's happening in rural counties, and it's happening in urban counties. So we have the hiring crisis, not enough applying, and then some of us in the larger offices are getting the double whammy, which is we're not only not being able to attract, but the ones that we do attract are turning us down. I can tell you when I became public defender in 2009, I think if two or three attorneys a year would turn us down, three applicants would turn us down, we would be shocked and horrified. How did you interview with us and to then turn us down? This year, I have already had, we interviewed 33 attorneys, 22 turned us down. I only have 11 lawyers to start in August when I need 40 lawyers to start in August. And you are hearing that in prosecutor offices and in public defender offices. The applications are down, and you already heard that. And the lack of affordable housing is having a ripple effect in our communities, particularly in public defender offices and state attorney offices. One of the things that is hard to comprehend, I have to, you know, go back to when I was in law school and when, you know, I rented an apartment. Now I own a home. But when I rented an apartment, I had to come up with first, last, and deposit, which is really 3 months' rent. Well, the average rent in Miami right now is $2,600 per month. The median median for a one-bedroom apartment. And that's if you can find one. And then they ask you for 3 months up front. These are law students who are graduating with tremendous amount of debt. A lot of them are moving to Florida, and they just cannot accept the jobs because of how much money they have to put up front. Some companies have allowed, some rental companies have allowed individuals to have another option, which is if they can show that their take-home pay is three times the amount of the monthly rent, then you're good to go. You don't really have to do the 3 months that you have to put up front. Or another one is run through a credit background check, which, of course, I'm not sure how many law students you come across with. Unfortunately, there are a lot of law students that are living on credit cards. I'm horrified by it, but that's me personally. But what happens with that is a lot of them end up having bad credit. So when they're trying to rent a place, it's nearly impossible, which is why we're having the problem of attracting so many people. And the turnover crisis is such that right now the turnover is 28% for public defenders. Before fiscal year 2019-2020, the average turnover for those previous 5 years was 17%. It's a big difference, and it's a big difference in numbers. This year, this fiscal year, we're only 6 months into it. I have already lost 30 lawyers. God willing, I will not lose 30 lawyers in the second half of my fiscal year, because I'll be in real trouble, because I won't need 40. I will need 60 new lawyers. And that's almost an impossibility, even if we get the salary increases that we're hiring. One of the last points that I wanted to make about the turnover is very different now, the turnover, than it used to be. We've all had to deal with turnover over the years. But the difference right now is that the turnover is much faster. I hired 34 lawyers January of 2021. I only have 17 of those lawyers in my office. That's 50% in 2 years. That is unsustainable for any prosecutor office, any public defender office. And that's happening. The last point that I wanted to make is the turnover impacts the backlogs. Because as the attorneys leave and there's no replacement for those attorneys, the caseloads go up, which then not only delays the cases, so you have, you know, justice delayed, but you also have the situation that the lawyers who stay behind have higher and higher caseloads. And of course, once you get into that situation, you feel incompetent. You feel like you cannot be representing the people of the state of Florida, either as a prosecutor or as a public defender. So I looked at the numbers. Right now, my open felonies are 21% higher. I have 8,837 felonies open as of today. Pre-pandemic, I had 7,266. That's 21% higher, and I don't have extra attorneys to be able to have in the felony division. So everyone is overloaded. Cases are delayed. Cases are slowed down, and we have a serious crisis in Florida. With that, any questions?
Thank you for your presentation. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, at the opening of your presentation, you may have misspoke. You said, and I quote, that there was large pay increases last year. It seems to me that one of the key areas to attract and retain competent prosecutors is to make sure that the pay structure is far much better than it currently is. And it seems to me that in listening to your presentation, this seems to be a key area that we may have to address immediately. Would you agree?
I completely agree. And in terms of the pay increase that we got last year, we got up to $10,000 per lawyer. This year we're asking for $15,000 per lawyer. So that way we can get to a point where we can actually attract and retain.
Thank you for that. Representative Casello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that presentation. My question is that when you hear the Miranda rights read to someone, and it says, if you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be appointed to you. My question is, what is that threshold where they cannot afford, and what is the formula they use to come up with that?
Sure. So the formula for that is up to 200% of the federal poverty level. Roughly speaking, about somebody making about $25,000. And of course, if they have dependents, there is a guide that for every dependent, you add a certain amount of money to get to the 200% poverty level.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they have to fall in that guidelines, and it's not automatically appointed to them. They said, I can't afford one. Okay, they have to follow that formula.
You're recognized.
Okay. It is not automatic. The court has to appoint. The individual has to complete an application. The clerk's office reviews the application, and the clerk's office gives either the green light or says this person doesn't qualify. Now, there are individuals that may be making $25,000 a year, but because of what their payments are, child support, and other issues that they have, the court may consider it to see if there's a hardship. And if there's a hardship, the court can still appoint the public defender.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. And in all fairness, I'm a criminal defense attorney, so this question is going to seem maybe a little self-serving. But in following up on that, I'm just doing, a quick look at your slides, and I don't know the page number, but the one that talks about new cases assigned 2021. Unfortunately, you go by fiscal year. FDLE doesn't. They go by calendar year. But in the calendar year of 2020, which is the most recent statistic that FDLE has up on their site, there were 508,490 arrests in the state of Florida. And if you look at that compared to 521,000, to Rep. Casello's point, and I understand your position that the clerk of courts is vetting these applications, but in terms of the vetting process for a truly indigent person, in my experience, and I'd like you to answer this if you know, it's really ministerial. They're looking at it on its face.
Right.
And therefore, the public defender is representing a great number of individuals who are not truly indigent.
So the first thing is the data. The FDLE data, depends what data you're looking at in FDLE. If you're looking at the crimes that they are to report to the FBI, that does not include all Florida charges. So that number would be skewed to begin with. We are appointed on criminal traffic cases as well. I forgot to mention criminal traffic cases. We are also, I can tell you, that in Miami-Dade County, of the misdemeanor arrests that are happening in Miami-Dade County, which is roughly 50,000 arrests last year, public defender only got appointed on 25,000. So it was 50% that we got appointed on. In criminal cases, we roughly average between 60 and 67, 68% of the cases we represent, unless we file a conflict, and then the Office of Conflict Counsel takes it over. But in Miami-Dade County, there's a robust private practice where individuals are actually seeking private counsel, or sometimes when we're representing them, they'll hire private counsel at some point in the future. But we don't represent 100% of people that are criminally charged in the state.
Thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you so much.
Finally, we are joined by Candace Brower, Regional Counsel of the 1st DCA Region with the Office of Criminal Conflict and Civil Regional Counsel. Candace Brower is the Regional Counsel for the 1st DCA Region of Florida. She is a state certified attorney in the area of juvenile law. Ms. Brower has served as chair of the Florida Bar Juvenile Rules Committee and was also appointed to serve on Special Committee for Parent and Child Respiration. She is on the Executive Council for Public Interest Law Section of the Florida Bar and is a member of a statewide dependency court improvement panel. Ms. Brower is also an experienced criminal trial lawyer. After earning her law degree, she worked as a criminal prosecutor in the 3rd Judicial Circuit of Florida, where she tried serious and habitual felony cases. Ms. Brower had her own practice in Gainesville before transitioning to the newly created Regional Counsel's Office in 2008. Ms. Brower, we look forward to your presentation. You are recognized.
Thank you so much, Chair Trunau, Vice Chair Barnaby. It really is an honor to be here before you today. Believe it or not, I know we're new in our creation, but this is the first time that we have been asked to give a presentation on who we are and our function. And so it is really an honor to be able to do this, because don't feel bad if you've never heard of us before. Everybody's heard of public defender and state attorney, and we stand side by side with them in court. And so it is an honor to finally to be here side by side talking about what we do, because it is so important. And I do want to echo the sentiments of Mr. Gladstone about attorneys starting their career at a state attorney's office. That's where I started my career. And I made enough to qualify for the services of the public defender back then. So we've come a long way, but I can't even imagine now having to start your career and not knowing how to try a case. So it is a shame. And we are all having the same or similar issues. We have the same retention and recruitment problems. And just it was only recently that we just started getting parity in some of our pay increases, but our attorneys still don't make the same retirement as they could make at the state attorney's or public defender's office. So these are things that extra issues that we certainly are facing. But we were just created in 2007. SB 1088 created us, and the primary purpose of our creation was just simply to save money. The price or the cost to the state of having to have private attorneys appointed to every criminal conflict case was skyrocketing, and it was growing exponentially for some reason, doubling in some places. But not only that, the state also has an obligation to pay for cases that are not criminal. There are several types of civil cases where you have a right to an attorney, and the state has to provide attorney services in that. The public defender does provide services for some civil cases, such as Baker Acts, but there are many, many others that the public defender does not handle. So although we are the second to be appointed in the criminal conflict cases, we are the first to be appointed in most types of civil cases. So since that started in 2007, the benefits of our creation far exceeded the expectations. Really, the expectation was just simply to save money. And we were sort of thrown together kind of quickly, and I suspect that's why we didn't have the same pay or retirement packages. But we started to create a whole host of lawyers that became experts in their field. We started becoming an integral part of serving families in dependency and termination of parental rights cases. We're now a part of protecting those parental rights, reunifying and keeping children with their families. And it was things that maybe were not expected, but they are certainly collateral benefits of our creation. Just real quick, this is just our map when we were created. If this map looks familiar to you, it's because it is the original map of the District Courts of Appeals. Rather than create one of us in every circuit, like there is a public defender and state attorney, the legislature, you all, decided to keep it a little simpler and created one in every district. So last year, when a new District Court of Appeals was created, thankfully, and thank you very much to all of you for allowing our offices to remain intact and maintain our original regions. So we still maintain the same five regions that we had when we were created. Now that we're established, it just made sense to keep us that way so we can continue seamlessly our function of representing our clients and also the cost savings, which really is, the reason for our creation. But I think it was a little more successful than anybody ever really imagined. So you can see on this chart, the dark blue line shows the trend of the cost to the state just rapidly rising. And then the year of our creation, that fell immediately. The very next year, the cost savings was felt by the state. And so it allowed us to keep going. We kept growing. So investing in us allowed us to continue our savings, and the light blue line shows the savings, and it continues every year. It fluctuates some every year, depending on what is going on in the state, but the savings is always there, and to date, JAC has calculated that we have saved approximately $419 million since our creation in 2007. So it's undeniable that we do save money, but it's not just the saving, it's the predictability of the costs to the state. Whereas before, when it was all private attorneys, it was hard to know how much the state would have to spend on that. So we're very proud of being able to be a part of the benefits of the fiscal impacts to Florida, and we do want to continue that. We have much less cases than the public defenders. 53,000 cases came through the regional counsel's office in 2022, most of them were criminal cases, the same criminal cases that the public defender handles, this including death penalty and death penalty resentencing cases. But in addition to that, the civil cases that our office is assigned to handle goes even beyond dependency cases and termination of parental rights cases. There's a lot of others you may have never heard of, such as tuberculosis control cases and court monitors. Just like the public defender, if they have a conflict with Baker Acts, we handle those, but we're the first in line for Marchman Acts and all the appeals related to those. Because that is what sets us apart and makes us different than the other criminal justice agencies, even though this is the Criminal Justice Committee, you will be overseeing things that have to do with us, but I wanted to show you the comparison of criminal cases to dependency cases. And the reason why attorneys are appointed to these cases. So just like in criminal cases, the state is seeking to interfere with a fundamental liberty right. In a criminal case, that would be the right to freedom. But in a dependency case, the state is seeking to interfere with a fundamental liberty interest, which is the right to parent. So it's been well settled that that you have a right to an attorney when the state is seeking to interfere with that. If you're indigent in a criminal case, you get the public defender first. If you're indigent in a dependency case, you get regional counsel first. Just like in a criminal case, the police need probable cause to arrest a person, which is the lowest burden of proof in the law. But in a dependency case, the state also only needs probable cause to take a child away from a parent, which is the lowest burden of proof. And we hopefully get appointed very soon after a child is taken. But the important thing to know about dependency cases, first of all, they are very important. Obviously, they're dealing with our state's families. But before our creation in 2007, there were very few attorneys who could actually specialize in representing parents. So since our agencies were created, it allowed attorneys to focus and specialize in what is actually a very complicated area of the law. And in 2017, the Florida Bar offered board certification in juvenile law, which they had never offered before, which that includes all of the statutes relating to Chapter 39, dependency and termination of parental rights, but also delinquency cases. So the DJJ cases, we represent children in delinquency cases, just like the public defender does. And we have several attorneys who specialize in both of those. And now we have several attorneys who are board certified in this area. And this has allowed us to utilize what's called the multidisciplinary approach to representing parents and families. And it's a proven method of parent representation, the utilization of social workers on the parent representation team. It shows other states fully utilize it, and reunification occurs at least on average 4 months faster, which saves the state money in and of itself. Also, for the first time in the state's history, we, the regional councils, have been granted entitlement to some federal funding called Title IV-E funding, which is used to benefit children who are not in the home with their parents. And this funding will be used to expand multidisciplinary representation. This is federal funding. The state does not have to pay for this, where we can use it to hire our social workers to help reunify families. And back in 2020, SB 96 codified that in Chapter 39 because the legislature knows that keeping children in the home and using this approach, best serves families and children. Despite all the great strides that we've made, there are still some problems that do need to be fixed that we are working on. Ensuring families have access to services, like I said, we get appointed once the child's been taken. It would be wonderful to work with the pre-preventative services to help keep families together. That is a goal of the Family First Prevention and Services Act that made the Title IV e-funding for us possible. It started in 2018, focusing on keeping children in the home. The only issue with that for us is we don't know about the case until it comes to court, until a child's already been removed, and we have experts ready, willing, and able to help with this if we're able to work on this pre-petition type of representation. Another problem that a heartbreaking problem that I've been dealing with since I started Independency 20-something years ago, is that there's still a disparate treatment between biological fathers and biological mothers. They do not enter the courtroom. Biological fathers do not often, especially in our field, in dependency, do not enter a dependency courtroom with the same protections as biological mothers. It's an inherently unfair problem in the law, and it's because of basically a legal glitch between legal fathers and biological fathers, and it is something that I'm hoping gets fixed very soon in the future, because we have some sad stories that we could share with you. So basically, I want to thank you again for giving us this opportunity to tell you all who we are, because we are a lesser-known part of the judiciary or the judicial system, but we are now focusing on a population that has traditionally been overlooked and underserved, we are proud to say we're a part in reunifying families. These are pictures of clients who have been reunified with their children who have given us permission to use use their pictures in these presentations. They're real people who have, our attorneys have made a difference in their lives. And not only that, we've been doing it with our original charge, which is to save money. And so we would ask you to keep investing in this legislative success, $400 million saved and counting. And if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Thank you for your presentation. Any questions?
Yep.
Representative Barnaby, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation, and thank you for that huge savings over a period of time that's brought $419 million saved to the state. I commend you for that. I would be honored if you would present to either myself or one of my colleagues in the legislature language that would correct the glitch, as you said, between biological fathers and biological mothers. It's something that we just can't speak about, but I believe with you that we need to address it here in the legislature. So I'd be honored if you'd present us with language, and perhaps we could look at a way to remedy that. Thank you.
Chair.
You're recognized.
Representative Barney, it is I who would be honored to discuss that with you, and thank you so much for that opportunity. I will bring you the language that I have been working on for many years now. Thank you.
Representative Bracy Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that presentation. I am a former DCF attorney. I worked at DCF when the shift was coming with the Office of Regional Council. So thank you, and I'm well aware of some of your challenges. I, too, was going to ask about the legal glitch and if we could have some more discussions about that as well. You made mentions of two things, if I may ask a series of questions. You made mention of benefits in retirement that is different than the PDs and a state attorney. Can you expound on that a bit?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that question, Representative. Yes, for the public defenders and state attorneys, we're granted what's called senior management services retirement. I believe it was in about 2003 or four. It was after I had already left the state attorney's office. It was done to try to retain and recruit attorneys, and it was given to all of their attorneys. It is a higher percentage rate that you can earn for retirement, it is usually reserved for people, who are in sort of senior management services. That's why it's called Senior Management Service Retirement. But it is a wonderful thing that a lot of the newer attorneys don't even realize that they're getting it because they don't look at their retirement. But we are still making, most of our attorneys are still making the regular Florida Management Services Retirement, which is a lower percentage rate that they're earning. The newer attorneys don't mind. We sort of give them that disclaimer. It's a deal breaker for some of the more experienced attorneys. And we actually had an experienced attorney leave us to go into a job where he could make a senior management service retirement. So we're just trying to catch up there, just make it something that we don't even have to bring up anymore. Certainly, equal pay with the same judicially related offices is imperative. But the retirement, the thing you don't usually think about, starts getting more important the more experienced you get. And all of us, I think, want to retain experienced attorneys and have attorneys who are willing to be sort of lifelong prosecutors or public defenders. And they it's unfair if they're choosing to do that and they can. But that is being worked on by the legislature. Thank you, Chair Brannon. He recently filed a bill to help fix with that for our more senior attorneys. It still won't bring us, all of our attorneys still won't be making it, but at least the supervising attorneys would be if it passes.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you talked about preventative services. I do agree that preventative services are so important when it comes to the lives of our families. What is it that you would need to be able to be involved in pre-petition services? Is it statute authority? What do you need?
You're recognized.
I believe we would need some statute authority. It's complicated because our office doesn't get involved unless there is a court case. So it's very difficult to try to become involved. But just like the public defender can be involved with diversion services and things like that without an information ever being filed, I think the same thing could be done in dependency, where maybe they're given Miranda rights of some sort and given our phone number so we can at least be able to help before it becomes an actual court case. So some logistics are going to need to be figured out with how that would take shape and how much more work that would take. But it's very hard for us to get a case where we know we could have helped before it came to us and we just didn't know about it. So just, and I know there has been some legislation proposed or about it in the past, so I could get that information to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Brannon? I
may not have a question. She covered what I wanted to touch on there. But so I don't violate the rules and just say that I'm making a statement, I'll find some question in here. Thank you, Public Defender's Office and the State Attorney's Office. Y'all share some of the same problems, but you each have unique issues in your own silos. And so my question, what will my question be? Is your agency the new redheaded stepchild of the criminal justice system? Because I've always been told by the public defender, Stacey Scott, that her agency was the redheaded stepchild.
You recognize.
Thank you. Yes, no, we are proudly taken that role away from Ms. Scott. I am happy to say, though, this legislature in the past couple of years has done a lot to make sure we're included. And as evidenced by this presentation here today and being asked to do it, that never would have happened 5 years ago. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gottlieb.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Candace. You and I have spoken numerous times over the past 5 years, and I think you know that I'm slightly hostile towards your agency. candidly, the number that you've saved, $420 million, and the asterisk that it's, the JAC has made this determination, is that just, I'd like to know the metrics by which they're making that. Are they including your brick and mortar and your insurance and everything that, I as a private lawyer, when I took these cases, and I only billed one case ever, in all honesty, which was a murder case, But I absorbed the cost of the secretarial, the brick and mortar, the paper costs, so on and so forth, and I doubt that this slide includes any of those costs to your agency compared to the cost of a private lawyer handling the case.
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That slide does include everything that is spent on us and everything that is spent on the private attorneys. Now, I don't know what a private attorney spends their own money on, but I'm just talking about what the state spends for us and for the private attorneys. And I have the breakdown. I can get that to you from JAC.
That was my next question. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. Since being created, does the framework that created regional councils have to be revisited by the legislature at any point?
It actually was revisited last year with the creation of the new DCA, and a lot of changes were made with an agency bill that was passed last year also to sort of fill in gaps where we were overlooked. Things as simple as access to courthouses or you know, that the public defenders and state attorneys have, protection for our investigators that the public defender and state attorneys have, those types of things were revisited last session. And thankfully, again, a lot of it was remedied. The pay, though, however, you know, that is always every year, just like the state attorneys and public defenders, something that has to be revisited. The regional councils have traditionally been about 30% less in pay from the top down than the state attorneys and public defenders, and we can't pay our attorneys any more than the cap or the most that we make, so we're always going to be sort of a little bit behind with that.
Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank everyone for presenting today and taking your time to give us the information we need to move this committee forward. I hope everyone feels like they have a better sense of what the importances of your organizations are. Moving forward, I'd like to use our time together to start focusing on hearing bills. That'd be great, right? And doing the work of the criminal justice system. Members, if there is no further business, that concludes our agenda for today's meeting. Representative Jock moves we rise. Unless there is an objection upon the motion of Representative Jock, this meeting is adjourned.